This program is provided by lawyer Kyungjin Kim.
If I told you that the entire foundation of the modern AI revolution, basically a trillion-dollar technological empire, started with just $600 and a trademark dispute over toilet paper, you'd probably think I was making it up.
Oh, absolutely. It sounds like a joke.
Right. But I want you to picture a very specific scene today. It is 1993, and we are not in some sleek, glass-walled Silicon Valley boardroom.
No, definitely not.
And we aren't in a sterile high-tech laboratory either. We are sitting in a Denny's diner, specifically on Berryessa Road in San Jose, California. You know the exact vibe.
Oh, yeah. The heavy, sweet smell of pancake syrup just hanging in the air.
Exactly. And there's that constant rhythmic clatter of heavy ceramic plates coming from the kitchen, plus the hum of, you know, late night conversations all around.
Yeah, that classic diner atmosphere.
Right. And right there, sitting in a high-backed corner booth, are three young guys. They're drinking endless cups of bottomless coffee, lean way over the table, and they are intensely drawing an entirely new computing architecture on a paper napkin.
It is such a wonderfully mundane setting for something so monumental. I mean, you look at that scene and nothing about it screams, you know, the future of global computing.
Not at all.
It completely shatters that romanticized myth of the startup garage that Silicon Valley absolutely loves to peddle.
Yeah, the whole Hewlett-Packard or Apple in a garage thing.
Right, exactly. We've all heard the legends of companies starting among power tools and oil stains. But this narrative, it proves something entirely different. It proves that paradigm-shifting ideas are often born over cheap, lukewarm coffee refills.
Fueled by caffeine and ambition.
Yeah. Fueled by this incredibly potent mixture of deep technical foresight and, honestly, a staggering amount of youthful audacity.
Which brings us to today's mission. You and I are going to unpack the events that started at that very table. Our source today is a fascinating book chapter titled Jensen Huang, Caesar of Silicon Chapter 3, Crossing the Rubicon.
It's like a great chapter.
It really is. We are going to trace the incredibly unlikely high-stakes origin story of a company that now essentially powers the modern world, which is NVIDIA.
Yes. And to really understand that audacity I just mentioned, we have to look at the looming deadline that actually put those three men in that diner in the first place.
Right, because there's a ticking clock here.
There is. Our central figure, Jensen Huang, was approaching his 30th birthday. This was going to be on February 17th, 1993. And the text notes something really fascinating here. The philosopher Confucius called the age of 30 Erip.
Erip, which means what? The age of standing firm?
Exactly. The age of standing firm, of establishing yourself in the world.
Okay, let's unpack this, because Jensen was treating that concept not as some abstract philosophy, but as a literal self-imposed deadline.
Right. It all traced back to a moment when he was 17 years old. He's standing in an electrical engineering lab at Oregon State University. He looks at his lab partner, who, by the way, was also his friend, and who would eventually become his wife, Lori.
Right.
And he makes this massive claim. He tells her, I will be a CEO by the time I'm 30.
Just a completely bold statement for a teenager.
Utterly bold.
And the wild part is, it wasn't just a sudden whim or, you know, a teenager trying to impress his girlfriend, because he actually anchored his entire life to that boast.
He really did.
If you look at his situation right before he turned 30, so at age 29, he had achieved what most people would consider the absolute pinnacle of the American dream. I mean, he had a master's degree from Stanford.
Which is huge on its own.
Right. Plus, he was pulling in a massive salary as a director at LSI Logic, and he had already built this formidable technical resume at AMD. He was safe. He had essentially won the corporate game.
He had won it so thoroughly that his own mother was begging him to play it safe.
Yeah.
She wanted him to just keep his comfortable corporate job.
Which, I mean, you can't blame her.
It's impossible to blame her.
Yeah.
When you have that level of financial security and prestige, the logical move is to just stay put, enjoy the view from the top of the mountain.
Yeah, exactly.
But Jensen was observing this tectonic shift happening beneath the surface of the industry. The personal computer era was booming, largely driven by Microsoft Windows. But the user experience was completely stuck in 2D text.
Flat windows, spreadsheets, basic word processors.
Right. 2D was the reality for everyday users.
Well, 3D graphics certainly existed at the time, but they were strictly confined to these exorbitantly expensive professional workstations.
Right. We're talking about rendering machines used by Hollywood studios or high-end industrial designers.
Exactly. Not something sitting in a family den next to the television. But Jensen fundamentally believed that 3D was inevitably coming to everyday household PCs. He realized that 2D wasn't just old technology, it was a computational dead end.
Yeah, he saw the ceiling.
He did. So he wasn't just jumping off a cliff into the fog, he was burning the only bridge to an island that was sinking. He knew the hardware paradigm had to change. But I have to ask you and push back a little here.
Sure.
Was this decision genuinely driven by profound technological foresight? Or was he just stubbornly trying to fulfill that romantic boast he made to his wife back in the lab?
That is the essential tension of his character, isn't it? I think it's inseparable. History is often shaped by these weird psychological catalysts. The chapter uses a very specific historical metaphor to explain this psychology, which is crossing the Rubicon.
Right, from the chapter title.
Exactly. In 49 BC, Julius Caesar brought his army to the banks of the Rubicon River. Roman law strictly forbade a general from bringing a standing army across that river into Italy. To cross it meant treason.
It was the ultimate line in the sand.
It meant the die is cast.
Yeah.
You either win the empire or you die. There is no going back to your old life.
So for Jensen, resigning from that directorship at LSI Logic, that was his Rubicon. Because, I mean, leaving a terrible job is easy. You have nothing to lose.
Oh, yeah.
But leaving a prestigious, high-paying directorship requires risking your entire established identity and, you know, your family's financial security.
You burn the boats.
He really did. Which brings us right back to that Denny's on Berryessa Road. Because once you cross your mental Rubicon, you need a war room.
You need a base of operations.
And he deliberately chose the place where he had learned his earliest life lessons.
This choice of location is incredibly revealing about his pragmatism. He didn't go out and rent some flashy, expensive office space to play pretend CEO. He went back to the exact diner chain where he had worked his very first job.
At age 15, right?
Yeah, 15. Washing dishes and bussing tables. It was an environment he understood deeply.
As a shy immigrant boy, that Denny's was where he first learned how to actually talk to strangers and handle the intense pressure of customer service.
Right.
But in 1993, the strategy for picking this specific booth was highly practical. It was simply quieter than trying to work at his house with his family. And like we said, the coffee was cheap and bottomless.
Yeah, you can't beat bottomless coffee for a startup.
Definitely not. But he didn't sit there alone. He brought two absolutely brilliant veteran engineers with him, Chris Malachowski and Curtis Preem. Both of them had deep foundational experience from Sun Microsystems,
which was a massive computing powerhouse at the time.
Exactly. They were the architectural muscle to Jensen's vision.
And they needed that muscle because they were trying to solve a specific, brutal, technical bottleneck.
Yeah.
It really comes down to architectural limitations.
Right. Let's break that down a bit for the listener.
So a standard CPU, the central brain of a computer, is brilliant at sequential execution. It calculates one complex operation incredibly fast, then it moves to the next, then the next.
Like a really fast chef making one meal at a time.
Exactly. Perfect analogy. But rendering a 3D environment isn't a sequential task. It is heavily parallel. To render a 3D world, you are mapping polygons. You're calculating lighting sources, rendering shadows, generating textures for millions of pixels simultaneously.
Right.
A traditional x86 CPU architecture just completely chokes on that kind of massive parallel math.
It's just too many things at once. So the idea they were sketching on that paper napkin was a dedicated helper processor, a completely new silicon architecture whose sole purpose in life was to take that massive parallel mathematical burden of rendering graphics entirely off the shoulders of the CPU.
That was the dream.
And they divided the labor to build this. Chris Malachowski took on the hardware design, Curtis Preem took on the software architecture, and Jensen, finally fulfilling that Oregon State promise, took the role of CEO.
He got there before 30.
He did. So now they just needed the money to incorporate and actually start building.
So they went to a prominent Silicon Valley lawyer, James Gaither, to formally incorporate the business. And the lawyer, naturally, asks for their initial capital.
Of course.
Jensen empties his pockets and finds he has exactly $200.
Wow.
He looks at Chris and Curtis and asks them to chip in $200 each. So this massive entity that would eventually reshape the global economy started with an initial capital pool of just $600.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though, because the irony of their naming process is just as staggering as the $600.
Oh, the naming story is fantastic.
They didn't start with some grand mythological vision for the brand. They originally wanted to name the company Envision, spelled N-V-I-S-I-O-N, which honestly sounds futuristic. It sounds like a solid tech company.
It does. Very 90s tech.
Right. But when they went to register the trademark, they hit a total wall because a toilet paper manufacturer already owned the trademark for Envision.
I still can't get over that.
A trillion-dollar technological empire was nearly derailed by bathroom tissue.
It's just brilliant. So they had to pivot immediately. They literally sat down and scoured through a Latin dictionary. They liked the letters N and V from Envision, so they searched for words starting with those letters.
Very systematic.
Yeah. And they landed on the Latin word invidia, which translates to envy.
Mm.
Curtis Priam loved it. He said their goal was to build a product so advanced it would make their competitors green with envy.
That's pretty clever.
So they dropped the first I, and that is how the name Invidia was born.
Starting with $600, a diner booth, and a name inspired by a toilet paper trademark dispute. It's almost poetic.
It really is the beautiful irony of this whole story.
But okay, so they had the team. They had the name. And they had the technical vision. Now they had to actually sell it to venture capitalists. And when they finally got into the room with investors, they hit a logical brick wall that would have stopped almost anyone else.
Yeah, the investors asked the single most devastatingly logical question you can ask a startup, pitching a highly complex hardware product. They asked, who is going to buy this?
Which is a fair question.
Totally fair. Because in 1993, PC gamers were perfectly happy playing basic 2D scrollers.
Mm.
3D PC games literally did not exist yet.
Right.
There was absolutely no consumer market for what they were building.
None.
Jensen famously referred to this as a $0 billion market.
I love that phrase.
It's brilliant because it captures the sheer absurdity of their pitch. You are asking VCs to give you millions of dollars to build a highly complex piece of silicon for a consumer base that currently numbers zero.
Right. So what does this all mean? Jensen's solution to this was what he called a radically interdependent flywheel strategy. He basically told the investors, we will not fight for market share, we will make the market.
Which is so incredibly bold.
It is. He proposed targeting video games specifically. And the reasoning goes much deeper than just, you know, liking games. Rendering 3D games in real time is technically the hardest computational problem you can solve for a consumer.
Yes.
It is vastly harder than rendering pre-calculated movies like Jurassic Park, which actually came out that exact same year.
Oh, that's right, 1993.
Yeah. But let me play devil's advocate here for a second. In 1993, targeting video games instead of enterprise business software seems like a terrible, almost childish business plan. Why on earth risk the company on gamers?
Right, from the perspective of a 1993 investor, it sounded crazy.
Oh.
Enterprise businesses have deep pockets. They buy reliable, high-margin software. Gamers, back then, were seen as just this niche, basement hobbyist market.
Exactly.
But the logic of the flywheel is what makes Jensen's strategy a masterclass. He understood the ecosystem dynamic. If NVIDIA makes good chips, developers will finally have the hardware canvas they need to invent 3D games.
The games couldn't exist without the hardware first.
Precisely. And if those 3D games exist, gamers will absolutely buy the chips to play them. The profits from those chips then fund even better chips, which enable even more complex games, and the flywheel spins faster and faster.
It's a self-sustaining loop.
Yeah. And to your point about enterprise versus gamers, enterprise software moves at a glacial pace. A business does not want to upgrade its entire fleet of computers every 6 months. They want stability. They want predictability.
Keep overhead low.
Right. But high volume entertainment. Gamers have an absolutely insatiable appetite for the bleeding edge. They will constantly pay for better graphics, faster frame rates, more realism. Jensen understood that this consumer market would drive hardware iteration infinitely faster than enterprise software ever could.
He wasn't just building a chip for a game. He was building an engine for rapid technological evolution.
Exactly. It's a masterclass in seeing not just what a technology is, but what entire ecosystem it can spawn. And they managed to convince the investors just enough to secure the initial seed runway to try and build it.
But, you know, securing that initial seed money and explaining the theory of a $0 billion market in a boardroom is very, very different from surviving the actual execution of it.
Oh, completely. Reality has a way of violently testing perfect theory.
It really does. And executing the strategy nearly destroyed the company multiple times. Their very first product, the NV1, was a commercial failure.
It was a disaster.
It was an undeniably powerful piece of hardware, sure, but it was too expensive because it stubbornly tried to do too much. It handled audio, graphics, it even served as a Sega Saturn joystick port all on one single card.
they wanted it to be everything.
Right. But the fatal flaw, the thing that really tanked it, was how they approached the software ecosystem. They stubbornly refused to adopt Microsoft's emerging industry standards for graphics.
Yeah, we need to explain the mechanics of that failure because it's a classic engineer's trap. NVIDIA designed the NV1 to render graphics using proprietary curved surfaces. Specifically, quadrilaterals.
Four-sided polygons.
Right. But Microsoft, who is pushing their new Windows 95 and the DirectX platform, decided that the industry standard for rendering 3D graphics was going to be based on triangle polygons.
Three-sided.
Exactly. Triangles versus quads.
And if you are a game developer in 1995, you are not going to code a completely separate, complex version of your game using quadrilaterals just for NVIDIA's niche hardware.
No way. It takes too much time and money.
You are going to code for Microsoft's Universal Triangle Standard so everyone can play it. By fighting the software ecosystem and believing their proprietary tech was inherently superior, NVIDIA essentially rendered their own hardware useless to the very developers they desperately needed to spin that flywheel.
And it almost killed them. I mean, NVIDIA nearly went bankrupt 3 separate times in their first 5 years. Jensen has stated that they operated every single day as if they were always 30 days from going out of business.
That psychological toll must be immense. Think about it. You've crossed your Rubicon, you left a highly lucrative career, you made this grand promise to your wife, and now you are constantly staring down the barrel of total ruin. 30 days.
It's terrifying.
And to demonstrate his absolute unwavering commitment to the team and to show he wasn't going to just abandon ship when things got terrifying, Jensen reduced his own CEO salary to exactly $1.
Wow.
He tied his personal survival entirely to the survival of that 30-day runway. He was fully in it. But they realized they had to make a massive, ego-crushing pivot.
They did. They had to swallow their pride. They completely abandoned their proprietary quadrilateral technology, which, you know, must have deeply hurt the engineers who spent years developing it.
Oh, letting go of your baby is the hardest part for any creator.
Exactly. But they wholly adopted Microsoft's triangle polygon standards for their next major chip, the NV3.
And that compromise is what saved the company. It worked. By 1999, they released a product called the GeForce 256. And with the release of that specific chip, they officially coined a brand new term for the industry. The GPU, or graphics processing unit.
The GPU was born.
The wild architectural sketch from the Denny's napkin had finally become a physical, world-changing reality.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this sequence raises a fundamental truth about the nature of innovation. Innovation without intense pragmatism is a death sentence.
That's a great way to put it.
The NV1 was highly innovative, but it was entirely unpragmatic. They only survived the wilderness because Jensen was willing to compromise his own technical ego and conform to the broader market standards when it really mattered. That specific flexibility is what separates the companies that survive to become titans from the ones that just become obscure footnotes in computing history.
Right. And looking back at the sheer terror of those first few years, Jensen offered a really profound quote in the text about the ordeal. He said, "If I knew how hard it was, I wouldn't have started."
It's such an honest admission.
It is. Ignorance is sometimes a founder's best armor. If you know exactly how massive and terrifying the dragon is, you never walk into the case. You just stay home.
Yeah, you take the safe bet.
Because he didn't fully comprehend how impossible a $0 billion market was to crack, he actually had the audacity to attempt it.
When we synthesize this incredible journey we've been talking about, we are looking at an arc that almost defies belief. It starts with a 17-year-old romantic boast in an Oregon engineering lab. It moves to a $600 startup funded from pocket change in a San Jose diner. It survives near bankruptcy and technical hubris in a market that literally did not exist yet, all to arrive at the definition of the modern GPU.
It's an incredible arc, and the story actually has an incredibly poignant coda. Fast forward to September 2023. Jensen Huang, now leading one of the most valuable companies on planet Earth, returns that exact same Denny's on Berryessa Road.
Full circle.
Completely. The CEO of the Denny's Corporation was actually there to meet him, and they presented him with a plaque that permanently marks that high-backed corner booth. It reads, "The booth that launched a trillion-dollar company."
What stands out most to me about that moment is what Jensen chose to emphasize. Standing there as a pioneer of the digital age, he didn't give a speech about silicon architecture or rendering pipelines or even artificial intelligence. He talked about restaurants.
He advised everyone listening to make sure they start their first job in a restaurant, didn't he?
He did. He explained that working in a restaurant teaches you hard work, It teaches you humility, and it teaches you how to bring joy to others.
Those were the exact lessons he learned washing dishes at 15.
Yes, and he carried them all the way to the helm of a trillion-dollar enterprise. It beautifully grounds the entire mythological Silicon Valley story back into human reality.
It really does. And for you listening to this, the relevance of the story goes far beyond just technology history. It is a massive testament to the fact that you do not need perfect conditions to start something monumental. You don't need a guaranteed existing market.
You don't need millions of dollars in venture capital seed funding on day one.
You don't even need a fancy office. What you actually need is a remarkably clear vision, a dedicated team willing to drink bottomless coffee with you, and the sheer courage to cross your own personal Rubicon.
The courage to throw the dice when the board hasn't even been built yet.
Beautifully said. But I want to leave you with one final lingering thought to mull over today. These GPUs, the specific chips invented purely to render 3D video games for kids, eventually became the computational heart of the modern artificial intelligence revolution.
Because AI requires massive parallel processing to train neural networks.
Right. Which happens to be exactly what the GPU was built to do all those years ago. But think about the fragile butterfly effect of history here. If a 17-year-old Jensen Huang had not made a bold, completely romantic promise to his girlfriend to become a CEO by age 30, he might have just listened to his mother.
He might have stayed at his comfortable corporate job. He would have never felt the pressure to cross the river.
Exactly. How much of our entire global cutting-edge AI future, all the medical breakthroughs, the autonomous systems, the vast digital landscape of tomorrow, is entirely dependent on a teenager's boast made decades ago and a conversation over the smell of pancake syrup in a San Jose diner? Keep that in mind the next time you sit down in a corner booth.
This program is provided by Lawyer Kyungjin Kim.